Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Bernour.
And
you guys ever feel like we should change the name to The Drill Down?
Yeah, it does.
Have like a special way of saying it.
The Drill Down. Hello and welcome like to match. The Drill Down. I'm just going to say it like George Takei.
Exactly. Oh, that would be perfect. Especially on Geeks of Doom. I wonder if we could actually get him.
Yeah, we are coming to you live on Geeks of Doom, as we do every week. And Our fourth compadre, Devinder Hardwar, is not here this week. He's got business, and so he's away on business. But on this week's show, we're going to talk about April Fool's Day on the web, Apple's upcoming revolutionary TV versus existing console-based options, and further bad times for Yahoo as Facebook strikes back. But first, let's get into some of our hot tech headlines for the week, shall we?
Let's.
So it's a bright sunshiny day for Android users, namely because photo sharing darling Instagram is now available in the Android market. Instagram's co-founder Kevin Systrom says that the iOS app has hit 30 million users after about a year and a half on the market, and with Android at 500 million activations, the startup has a real chance of hitting 100 million users across both devices soon enough to matter. Now, to put that in perspective, Facebook took about 4 years to reach its first 100 million. The idea of Instagram becoming the world's first formidable mobile-only social network is extremely compelling. What do you guys think? Do either of you have an Android phone?
I have one, not anymore.
You don't use it anymore. You still have it.
I don't use it anymore. It's my 3-inch tablet.
Ah.
That sits next to my bed. Basically a $600 alarm clock.
You know, that actually reminds me to go off topic for just a second here. And I should have put this in what we're playing with. But I downloaded an app for my new... I'm in that second stage of owning the iPad, where the first stage is like, look at the iPad and all of its wonderfulness on its own. And now I've moved on to the second stage where I'm exploring different apps and stuff. And so in that stage, I bought an app called Air Display. And basically what it does is it turns your iPad into a second display for either a Mac or a PC server so that you can have that extension. So, like, for example, I was using it last week with my laptop, which is typically, my desktop, I've got two screens side by side. In my laptop, I'm stuck with one screen. So I use the
Air... Stuck.
Well, if you use your computer like
problems.
I do...
I know.
Yeah, really. So I use the Air Display to extend that...
How much was the app?
It's like $10, but you
That's
can...
It?
Yeah, and you can use it on like multiple systems.
Hmm.
But just to, like I said, go off topic, that I've been having a lot of fun with that. So not only that, but not only does it work with your iPad, but I believe it also works with your iPhone if you wanted a really tiny second monitor screen. To bring it back around to what you were saying, Chris, about the 3-inch tablet.
My 3-inch tablet.
Yeah,
it's actually what it is, Chris. It's an iPod Touch. That's what you have. You have an iPod Touch that happens to be an Android device.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to use it for dev work in some way. It's the main reason why I'm keeping it around.
But you're not going to put Instagram on it?
No, I just haven't gotten around to it. Mm-hmm. I heard that it came out like a day or two ago, and I've been meaning to put it on just to compare it. Although it's a pretty old Android device, and given that it has issues...
Droid Incredible?
Yeah. It's 2 years old. That's an eternity in Android years.
Kind of
I
is.
Guess so. My girlfriend's like, using a 3DS and she has no complaints.
Well, that's because Apple's iPhones still work, you know, 6 months after you buy them. Sorry, that was my biggest thing that annoyed me about Android is that, you know, I bought the Incredible, and for the people who haven't listened to the Symbiotic podcast, I was a huge Android proponent at the beginning, and I went out and I bought the Incredible as soon as it was available because I didn't want to switch away from Verizon, you know, loved it totally for the first 6 months, but it ceased to be a usable platform after about 8 months, and by a year and a half after I had bought it, it was almost unusable. Just like the UI was unbelievably slow. You know, couldn't run half the apps in the App Store. Huge amounts of lag. It just was a very unfortunate experience. But I'm excited to see how Instagram looks on it.
You know, it's interesting. I found it humorous that one of the first responses was from John Gruber, who took an exact same picture with the exact same filter using an iPhone 4, and then using the whatever latest Android phone that he had, and I think he was setting out to prove that the iOS version took better pictures, or at least the iPhone took better pictures, and you know,
it wasn't true.
No, it did end up that the iPhone did take better pictures, but it was humorous to me that he went out of his way to make that point.
Actually, in that sense,
well, doesn't it depend on which Android device you have?
Yeah, sure it does. Yeah,
and that seems to actually be more of an advantage for Android on Instagram. I mean, let's think about Instagram's business model. Instagram's business model amounts to, like, phone cameras take crappy pictures, so we'll replace them with artistically crappy pictures. So for an even worse phone, like on an Android phone, making it look stylized and artistic seems to be more of an advantage than on an iPhone where it already looks pretty decent.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean that's an excellent point.
I didn't actually see that article, but should we talk a little bit about Instagram itself and the fact that it's this giant picture sharing app?
Yeah, about Instagram, I think the implications here are actually bigger than they're huge because Facebook is a company that's got, you know, thousands of people working for it. Instagram has like less than 40. And they're already at 30 million users. They waited. They seriously waited. They started up like a year ago, year and a half ago, however long ago. And they were only iOS. And everyone's sitting there and they're like, when are you coming out on Android? When are you coming out on Android? And because they were so focused on this app and its functionality and how good it was, you know, it took them forever in software terms to come out with this the Android version. And of course they had to contend with lots of different you know, versions of Android, and of course they had to do this and that. But in the end, I feel like it's one of the true things where you look at the quality focused on the quality of the software, and you see how they focused on that and how time wasn't a factor. Like when Blizzard releases a game, it'll be ready when it's ready, kind of thing. And that I really kind of appreciate. And I do think that they'll have astronomical growth. I know that the Android market's been ripe with clones for a while, but now that the real McGilla's on there and you can share cross-platform, it's going to be big. It's going to be very, very big. And I think this is going to really – this stamps out things like Path that were supposed to be photo sharing. You know,
right.
Et cetera.
Right.
You know.
Path.
Yeah,
is...
you know, I don't know anyone who uses Path.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I still love it. It's still beautiful, but
– I think Path – I don't know. I've always hated Path. So.
They were misguided and ambitious at the same time.
We should bring these guys up again when we talk about Yahoo a little bit later on in the show because, I mean, this is Flickr. Like, Flickr should be doing this.
Exactly.
I think even more so than Facebook. I mean, Facebook has apps, I mean, has pictures as a feature that it socializes around. But, I mean, Flickr was the social app thing. And,
it's social photo sharing site. It was the premier photo sharing site.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on here. While the official reveal of Sony's next home console could be months away still, if not longer, Kotaku has learned some important details concerning the PlayStation 3's successor. For one, the console's name, or at least its code name working title, is apparently Orbis. and it's being planned for release in time for the 2013 holiday season. They also got some specs, a few specs that they're given out, that they're the information they're given out to developers from sources, trusted sources, and their specs are AMD X64 CPU and AMD Southern Islands GPU, which is capable of displaying Orbis games at a resolution of 4096 by 2160, which is far in excess of the current HDTV sets. And it'll be capable of playing 3D games in 1080p, which beats the current PS3 resolution of 720p. But one of the most interesting things about this announcement that that I found interesting was that that they're going to be having anti-used games measures built into the console. So, in other words, if you buy a game to play in this new console, it's got to be locked to a single PSN account, after which you can play the game, save the whole thing to your hard drive. What's that?
So, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
Or peg it as downloaded in your account history and be free to download it at a later date. But used games, it's believed, will work on this system by it's going to be limited to a trial mode or some other form of content restrictions, with consumers having to pay a fee to unlock or register the full game. That would allow used games to continue to be sold at outlets such as GameStop, while also appeasing major publishers who would no longer have to implement their own approaches to online passes. So, in other words, you can still play used games in it, but you have to pay.
When you say used games, you mean like your games from before, like your PS3 games?
Well, first of all, it's going to it's not. This system is said to not be PS2 compatible. So
I know, but I'm talking PS3 games because this is the post PS3. Yes,
I'm not entirely sure whether it's even going to be PS3 backwards compatible. That's not the issue. The issue is Orbis games. In other words, used Orbis games. Like, you won't be able to buy used games for this system without paying some sort of an unlock fee to register the full game once again.
So I mean, like, that means GameStop has to build that fee in to their pricing.
Yes, or you build it into, or when you buy a used game from GameStop and plug it into your PS4, your Orbis, you'll have to pay the fee through the PlayStation Network, for example.
Right, right. I'm saying, like, if it's burdensome. So if they're used to selling a $60 game for $25 after a year or something, then they're going to have to sell that for $25 minus the PS3, the PS Orbis cost, right? Because, like, unless
one
the
would
users
hope.
Just
one,
like, brainwashed into just dropping mad cash on it, it's incredibly burdensome to buy a game and then pay for its use to Sony. I mean, that's painful. Yeah.
How is this going to affect? And I know we don't have the answers to this right now, but actually, what worries me is how is it going to affect, like, the sort of like casual game loaning slash like swapping that often happens. I mean, like, you know, my friends and I go to a LAN party and we make sure that, you know, there's four or five copies of Brawl, Smash Brothers Brawl, you know, and we all just, you know, I don't know if I have the right version when I come back. As long as it's a disc that works,
It stops that. I mean, it effectively stops that for online play.
I think you're right.
The whole point of this is that they don't want that. They look at that as you know, problematic for their publishers. The publishers don't want that. They don't want that. Nobody wants that who actually makes the content. Content owners want everyone to have their own version of content. My big question is, if I buy a game on the Orbis, I like buy it and I have two PS3s in two different rooms in my house.
Yeah.
You know, one's in the den and one's in like the West Wing or something. Can I use that on both? Or, you know, I have the same account, obviously. So, like, how's that work?
You know, I think if you have the same PSN account, I believe so. So the games are going to be locked to the individual PSN accounts, it sounds like.
Okay. So here's one question about this. I mean, why are we still buying games on disc? We don't buy movies on disc anymore. We don't buy music on disc anymore. It's not like it's that much more bandwidth to just – actually, it's significantly less to distribute a game because you only have to do it once. I mean, honestly, from the point of view of the game pleasure, it would seem that
it's because of the secondary market.
Be down. Really?
I think it's on some level it might be because of the secondary market. On another level, I'm really not sure. There are plenty of downloadable games on these systems now. I think when you're looking at Netflix, for instance, they're able to stream a game, stream a film. A film is only active one way. They give you the film, right? And you see it as you watch it, and then, you know, when you're done, it's over. But they're only giving you a little bit at a time. You look at things like Steam. Steam requires like a serious amount of bandwidth, right? Like, I'm talking serious. You're downloading 4 or 5 gigs at a time. Yeah. I can see cable operators freaking out if the actual general console situation, like the vast majority of that data was being transferred over their networks. You know what I mean? So that'd become burdensome to the networks. And I feel like we're also dealing with Sony, who doesn't make sense a lot of the time.
Well, and they also don't understand the online networks that well.
Yeah,
right.
They're not. I mean, Sony, I don't know, like between like their issues with like PS whatever and the way them and you know, everything they've done with media has sucked, right? Let's just go into a little bit of detail. They had Betamax, you know, that didn't take off.
Mm-hmm.
They had the memory stick, the original one, that was a piece of junk. The mini disc, they had the new memory stick, which is basically like they have to acquiesce to the fact that everyone was using SD cards, so they made a memory stick that fit SD cards. And now they've got, you know, and now they've got they had the fight with Blu-ray, and they finally won something. Yay, Sony. And Blu-ray is on its way out because people like downloadable content. The Apple TV and devices like it, like the Xbox, are really taking off.
They won good fight for physical content.
Yeah, I mean, like, they just don't, at least maybe our market. The Japanese companies like to tell the consumer what's up.
Yeah.
And not look at what the market's doing because they figure they can like get one over on the market. But the invisible hand is typically, you know, beat Sony the fuck back when it comes to their their storage solution. So I mean, it's Sony in the end.
All right, let's move on here. The king of Twitter is now the king of Apple as 2.5 Men star Ashton Kutcher is attached to play Steve Jobs in the indie pick Jobs. Which Joshua Michael Stern, who directed Swing Vote, will direct from a script by Matt Whiteley. The film will chronicle Steve Jobs from wayward hippie to co-founder of Apple, where he became one of the most revered creative entrepreneurs of our time. Sony Pictures is currently developing its own Steve Jobs pick based on Walter Isaacson's book. What do you guys think about this? Ashton Kutcher as Steve Jobs?
I couldn't care less. I don't know why anyone cares what Ashton Kutcher does. It doesn't matter. You know, we all knew the biopic was coming, especially with the book being out.
Sure.
We all knew there was going to be a couple of them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why we couldn't have seen something like this while the guy was alive. I think there was plenty of room to have a somewhat comedic reinterpretation of, like, you know, the guy's the you know, the kings of Silicon Valley kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, I don't know. I just, you know, it's these are the kinds of movies you don't see in the theater. These are the kinds of movies that there's not going to be like wonderful 3D or awesome 7.1 surround. So you'll catch it on, unless you really need to see Ashton Kutcher portray Steve Jobs, you'll catch it on video when it comes around. You know what I mean? So it's just not.
Who would you?
I don't know. I think it looks. I mean, I think it makes sense. Uh-huh. Ashton Kutcher is trying to push his sort of status in the valley, and he kind of looks like an old plane just flew.
He looks like the young Steve Jobs.
Yeah, he looks like a young
Steve. Could be made to look like a young Steve Jobs fairly convincingly and fairly easily. He's also coming out of the wake of his, you know, terrible breakup with the super actress he was with for a long time, and he was under her shadow. So playing, you know, the most powerful tech person in the world has ever seen is probably something that he's looking forward to from a career perspective.
Who would you cast as Steve Jobs for the big Sony picture based on the Isaacson book?
I'd find someone that people.
I think if you're going to cast for the biography, you cast someone. You have an open casting call and you cast who you think is right. And I actually think this is the same for like comic book movies or whatever. Whenever the character is already established in the understanding of the culture, you go out and you find the person that best like conveys what the director feels about it. You don't necessarily have to find, you know, an A-lister, B-lister, whatever, someone that everybody, you know, some actor out there. So I think that if you really want to get the art done correctly, you go out and you find the actor that can best portray that.
Maybe a complete unknown.
Yeah, exactly.
A relative unknown, like Jesse Eisenberg with Zuckerberg.
Exactly. Yeah,
he was
exactly.
awesome at that. He did an awesome job.
He was.
And that's I mean, that's part of what I think Hollywood just needs in general. Just like the app world has kind of made it so individuals can like step into Silicon Valley and get things done and like, you know, whatever. I think on some level Hollywood needs to start stopping away from these like stars, calling them bankable, whatever, and just start looking for real talent that can get real things done. And I think there's no better place than in biopics.
Yep. All right, let's move on here. Speaking of Apple, in a landmark development for the way Western companies do business in China, Apple said on Thursday that it had agreed to work with partner Foxconn to tackle wage and working condition violations at the factories that produce its popular products. Foxconn, which makes Apple devices from the iPhone to the iPad, will hire tens of thousands of new workers, clamp down on illegal overtime, improve safety protocols, and upgrade worker housing and other amenities. The moves come in response to one of the largest investigations ever conducted of a U.S. company's operations abroad. Apple had agreed to the probe by the Independent Fair Labor Association in response to a crescendo criticism that its products were built on the backs of mistreated Chinese workers. The association, in disclosing its findings from a survey of three Foxconn plants and over 35,000 workers, said it unearthed multiple violations of labor law, including extreme hours and unpaid overtime. So this is a good thing. Until
Americans start complaining that their iDevices cost more.
Well, you know what? We had this discussion before about a premium price for Apple products made in the United States, and I would be okay with even with a little bit more of a premium for Apple products that I knew came from fair market from.
You want free-range Chinese workers and not yes, caged Chinese workers.
Exactly.
That's kind of what it comes down to. Exactly. And, yeah, I mean, I'm just going to say it. Let's just put it out there. Yes. And this is what happened when Apple first made the aluminum chassis. Greenpeace said that Apple's products, they were not environmentally friendly. They had all these problems with the environment and, like, you know, all these PCBs. Apple went out. They looked around. They said, hey, we can actually make money with these green chumps, by making these aluminum devices. They're going to be stronger. They're going to last longer. They're going to cool better, whether it's unibody or the time before unibody, by using aluminum. And within like 3 or 4 years, the Apple devices are the most eco-friendly devices around. So there's a market. They can find that market. They can look at that market and say, look, when you buy that Android phone from Taiwan or whatever, you don't know what kind of labor is going on. But like Starbucks and Fair Trade, you know, we are going to give you organic Apple products free from like, you know, hormones and like slave labor and all these things that, you know, the average Whole Foods purchaser is always thinking about. And I think that there's money to be made in that. People will pay for that.
But also I think, you know, there's that saying, a rising tide raises all boats. Something like
that. Yeah, that's not actually true economically, but okay.
But I mean
trickle down economics was based on that principle. It helped nobody.
Well, but I think I understand where the direction Andrew's going to go with this. I mean, like, given the amount of hardware that's produced in Foxconn factories, Foxconn's not going to be like, okay, for these particular plants, we're going to, you know, just change this. Like, well, I mean, they might. But I think it's very likely that this
they
is
absolutely
be a
will, Chris. They will absolutely this is going to affect those products under which there's scrutiny. This will not affect any other products because the market won't allow it. And China is far more competitive than we are when it comes to getting things done at whatever. And you know, as much as all these labor laws may have been taken care of, we've been seeing Foxconn's amazingly large operation continue with these practices for the duration of at least the iPhone, if not before. So that's 5 years. In 5 years, one of China's big money makers wasn't looked at by China at all. They don't obey their laws. The reason why that crazy earthquake happened and 12,000 people died or whatever, was because the buildings aren't built to code. Because the amount of competition to get things done cheaply trumps law. It's not America, and we can't think of it like America. And that's why I don't think that this is necessarily going to rise all boats. I think they're going to be like Motorola Mobility, now owned by Google, might take take a step in this direction so that they can market the fact that their phones are made, you know, well or whatever. And maybe that will lift things. But they're not just going to lift stuff just because they can. There's going to be scrutiny on Apple products alone.
But it's not like their factories are divided up into like, well, this is the Apple-only factory.
Oh, but Chris, it is. It's exactly what it is. Apple builds the factory. Apple says Foxconn, the reason why the glass is so tight on the iPhone and it took 5 years for Android to catch up, because Apple says we have this glass process that we've developed. We need you to build it. We will build that factory, and that's how the secrecy is maintained. If that wasn't the case, the secrecy wouldn't be maintained, and we wouldn't be able to – we'd find copycat devices much more quickly than we have. That's part of Apple's whole supply chain. They build the factory. They have an exclusive process, and that factory becomes Foxconn's property after X amount of years, and Apple moves on to the next thing with the next innovation or whatever. That's what Tim Cook has been doing ever since the iPod came out, ever since they moved their manufacturing over to China. So the real question is, how much did Tim Cook know being the logistics operator for this whole thing? He's the guy.
Yeah, that is a good question. And not only that,
these are the questions that the press isn't even asking, which is why, but you hear me frustrated with the tech press. It's because the press isn't looking into this. They're not investigating it.
And before
Mike Davis shows up and they just say whatever, and then like they complain about that when that like gets exposed.
And this has been on Tim Cook's plate for a long time, because before he was the CEO of Apple, he was the chief logistics guy.
Yeah, he was the chief. That's what I was saying. During the creation of the iPod back in the early 2000s, Tim Cook was popping this stuff out to China. He was figuring out what to do in the wake of Bill Clinton's opening up trade negotiations with China in 1998. So he's been at the heart of all of this, and now he's the CEO. And you know, like this is on his plate. Like, what did he know? Interview Tim Cook, find out what he knew, and if he knew this kind of stuff, throw the bum out. If he didn't, then we find that out. But I mean, these are the hard questions that people are afraid to ask, because all the tech journalists want Apple to give them the exclusive test of Mountain Lion, or give them the new phone before it comes out or whatever. So they're afraid to ask these questions.
Well, I think it doesn't hurt that people are going to be looking at Apple, and people are going to be looking at the companies that make the other products, that electronic products that they own, and say, why are my products being made to the fair trade practices that Apple's making their products? And that's basically what I meant by rising tide supports all boats.
Yeah, I guess I could see that.
Okay, let's move on here. So Girls Around Me is a standard geolocation-based maps app, similar to any other app that attempts to alert you to things of interest in your immediate vicinity, whether it be parties, clubs, deals, what have you. It's when you push the radar button that Girls Around Me does what it says on the tin. It immediately goes into radar mode, and the map fills with pictures of girls in the neighborhood, and these girls are publicly are tracked through their publicly available and visible Facebook profiles.
Facebook or Foursquare?
Facebook
or both?
and both. Facebook and Foursquare, after checking in to both, and then it shows you a map of where the girls are in your area are trackable by Foursquare area. If there's more than one girl in location, you see the number of girls there in a red bubble. This raised attention on a number across the blogosphere, and it wasn't too long before the group that developed the app pulled the app itself. But it was basically, it brings out about a bigger question. This was an easily made app based on readily available information on Facebook and Foursquare.
Public information pushed through APIs to be leveraged as data is often leveraged for an end. You know,
yes.
The data is out there. The data is free. Mark Zuckerberg himself said in 2009 or 10, the default is social. People have control over these things. And the fact that it was being used for this isn't new, right? Like this app in another form came out a long time ago. It's called Where the Ladies At. We talked about it on the Symbiotic podcast. That's how old it is. And Where the Ladies At used Foursquare check-ins to allow someone who's in New York or San Francisco or in Austin, Texas, to pull out their phone and find out where the most females checked in and go to that club. Right?
Right.
And that's this has been around.
I remember that.
Exactly. We talked about it on the podcast. This is data that's been around, and this is kind of one of those things. It's like Path. Remember when Path had the whole, hey, we keep your contacts and we keep your contacts, and it's a big thing?
Exactly.
You know, these guys got caught. It's kind of like when you're a kid and the other kid does something just as bad as you, but the teacher saw you. She's like, I didn't see him do it. Right. So this app has been around forever. This implementation of the data has been around for a very long time, technologically speaking. So again, tech press, fail. It's like they're not really looking into what's been around here. Maybe where the lady's at will get a second look or something like that. But I'm looking at the App Store right now. I can buy it for 99 cents. And frankly, I don't think it's a bad thing. You know, like if you're going to share where you are, you're going to share where you are. And the fact is, if you're a lady and you're out at a club on a Friday or Saturday night and you've checked in with a whole bunch of your friends, you're checking in because you either want other friends to see you or you want to remember it or whatever. But the fact is, there might be more guys there now. And if you're out, you might be out. I mean, your chances are, I mean, they're not 100% chances, but chances are you're out looking for the opposite sex or whatever. Or if you're gay, you can still use where the lady's at, whatever. But the bottom line is, clubs are focused on how many women they can get in the club. That's the whole nightlife model. Mm.
Like, but that's not the point behind though this one. But this is just literally like who's in my neighborhood, like wherever I am at the moment, you know.
Sure.
And I guess that's probably why it seems like it has a much creepier feeling, because it's sort of like, you know, it's like prime stalker material.
All of it is prime stalker material. I just feel like this is the people, like there was even stories about people breaking into other people's houses because they knew they had checked in far away from their house.
I remember
that's what social is. That's the danger of social. And I know
it's particularly the danger of like geographical social. I mean, like
location based.
I'm totally okay like being very, 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 very public on the internet with myself, but that's one line that I don't cross. Like my Foursquare and my Facebook is all set to be, you know, just the people that I've set to be my friends within those networks because that, you know, it's an important question where you are. So I guess, you know, I'm glad that people are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good point. Well, I only check in when they leave because I forget. Also, I like get there and like it takes like 10 minutes to check in. So,
yeah, I just feel like this is like a big to do about stuff that's been out for a long time. And yes, it's culturally a little off, but everything about Facebook. If you brought today's Facebook to us in 2004 or 2005, culturally we would have gawked. Even remember like everything, like from the timeline. Why is everybody stalking me? To the whole check in thing. Why is everybody stalking me? To pictures and tagging. Why is everyone stalking me? Like, that's the mantra of our world today. Why is everyone stalking me? And if you really have a problem with it, get off the social network. Stop the open graph. You can do it. You have the choice. But that's these things cost, and the cost is having that data out there. That's the cost. There's a material cost. Facebook isn't free. Foursquare isn't free. The idea is that you're paying by having that information out there. So
yeah, but perhaps the lesson here is that it is basically making people aware that this implementation is possible, and curbing their interaction with the social graph to avoid getting stalked, essentially getting stalked and getting raped.
Yeah, I mean, I read something recently that said something like privacy should be like security. It's not an option.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know how many conversions this would stop or whatever, but I don't really see why. And I mean, Apple does a relatively good job with the whole pop-ups, like share your location, whatever. But yeah. I feel like they're definitely in this whole world of do not track and the emerging world of do not track and location focusing on everything, especially at South by Southwest this year. There's definitely room to focus on this idea that privacy and security should be on the same level. Privacy shouldn't be a series of options. Privacy should be the default, and you've got to like take it away. You got to open yourself up, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there's a balance there, and yeah, it's there's something to be done.
All right, let's move on here. Now, Dwayne, you added this link to our notes about the federal court tossing out Colorado law meant to spur online retailers like Amazon to collect state sales tax.
Right. So this is really quick. Colorado, Oklahoma, a couple others have tried to tell Amazon.com that they need to collect sales tax from the individuals that are buying their product, Amazon's, you know, products, mm-hmm. In those states. Amazon said, well, I'm not actually in your state. I just deliver there. I don't have like a big center there. I don't do whatever. I just deliver to that state. And Colorado's like, no, you have to do this. So they passed this law. The Democrats passed this law back in 2010. Amazon took them to court. The court said, okay, pending further review in a higher court, we're going to put this law on pause. And then today in the higher court, they threw it out saying it's an undue burden against companies that are out of state for them to have to collect taxes when, in fact, that's just not the way the internet works right now. So that's like the long story short. It means that the affiliate program for Amazon affiliates will probably be reopened in Colorado because Amazon doesn't have to pay tax here. And there's going to, you know, they trickle into Oklahoma and some of the other states that haven't been able to strike the same sort of deal like California and New York have with companies like Amazon. Which is to say, if you have a big fulfillment center here, if the people are being employed, this is where you're working out of, then you have the people have to pay sales tax. And that's kind of, you know, it makes it so that Amazon is focused on being as lean as possible. So from a business perspective, I think this is a pretty cool situation for Amazon, at least. I think that, you know, in for Colorado and other states that are hurting because of budget deficits, they feel like this is a burden to them. But, you know, otherwise, I think in terms of commerce and getting people to spend, which is one of the big issues with the economy right now, it's going to be pretty helpful.
So. You know, this is one situation where I'm actually pretty sympathetic with the states. I mean, Amazon and online commerce represents a huge, you know, cut in a fairly major revenue source for the states, and something that like just simply didn't exist. I mean, like the part of the problem is, you know, it used to be before that if, you know, the economy improves and people start buying more, then sales tax revenues go up. But the problem with Amazon is that, you know, you have people in your state who are buying things in your state, who are using them in your state, but you have no way of collecting any tax on that.
Well, they're actually buying things out of your state. That's the whole point. That's why it works.
Because they're buying it from out of your state, but they're buying it, I mean, in your state. Like, you're getting
something. Yeah, but if I were to call L.L. Bean on a catalog 30 years ago and say, hey, I want something, there wouldn't be tax there either. Unless they were being charged. You know what I mean? So it's just that it's been scaled up. And I feel like, the states are hurting, but it also means that, you know, you can also say local businesses are hurting, whatever. In Colorado, local is a really big thing. But at the same time, it means that we have to look at the reason Amazon's been successful is because their ability to fulfill has been efficient and mean and is good. And I think that being a burden on that level of fulfillment and forcing Amazon to have to go through things that, you know, other out-of-state companies don't have to go through or that in-state companies don't have to go through, that's also problematic. So I'm not saying this is the golden solution. I have a feeling that there'll be new legislation that deals with the problems the court addressed. But I do think that we have to keep that spice flowing, and I think it's only gonna you know, stop commerce.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, at the same time, I also am somewhat sympathetic to Amazon in this situation. I think I honestly think it would be fair for Amazon to have to pay, you know, sales tax for the states that it delivers to.
Yeah, and remember, this isn't about Amazon paying stuff. This is about Amazon
charging it. Yeah, that's what I mean. Charging it when you buy your thing. But you know, the problem where it really could become onerous is, you know, there's nothing to stop municipalities from charging sales taxes too, and then you get yourself in a situation where, you know, Amazon has to have, you know, figuring out the different sales tax laws for literally every single, you know, municipality in the entire country. And that does get to the point where, you know, it's just almost impossible to even keep track of.
Those things are changing, you know, on an annual and semi-annual basis. You know, the tax holidays you have to think about. Where is the person buying from? Are they visiting there? Are they actually there? Where is their actual residency? It becomes crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on here. Google, undaunted by a short-lived attempt to market and sell smartphones on its own, is now trying the approach with tablet computers in a quest to capture market share from Apple's iPad. Google will sell co-branded tablets directly to consumers through an online store like rivals Apple and Amazon, according to people familiar with the matter. This must come from Wall Street Journal, because Wall Street Journal always says, according to people familiar with the matter, when they're referring to their sources. The move is an effort to turn around sluggish sales of tablet computers powered by Google's Android software. Details of the project remain unclear, including when Google plans to unveil the online store. So you think this strategy will work for Google? Is it going to help them take down the iPad? Well, obviously, I think the iPad is too well entrenched.
Yeah. I feel like this can't hurt. It can't hurt, right? Like, it can't hurt to have an online store for tablets. It can't hurt to have a central resource. Because the thing about the phones is that they stopped selling the phones online, but they definitely have a lot of information about the phones online. And if they at least have that, that's helpful. I think what we've learned from Apple is that – we learned this from both Apple and Dell, that having your expensive device inside a place where people can pick it up, touch it, and play with it will sell more devices. Dell swore it would never do that. Direct to the customer, it's the best deal. They only build products when people order them because they're super efficient. And Apple went the exact other way. Here's the Apple Store. We're opening up a store. You can actually touch these products. And in the end, Apple won on that because when people are spending more than $100 on something, it turns out, they actually want to pick it up and touch it and know what the hell they're buying.
Well, especially when it's a touch device.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think Google's in a much better position to do this than they were when they tried doing it with phones.
Yes.
I mean, first of all, it's a market that doesn't have the same like lock-in problems that the cell phone market has. Yeah.
Unsubsidized devices and devices that don't require – you can sell a Wi-Fi-only device that does not require a connection to a company.
Yeah, I mean, trying to sell it to unsubsidized phone might have not worked even if they were doing it not in store. They also have a much larger store infrastructure than they did back then. I mean, think about it. When they first started selling the Nexus One on – the only thing that Google bought or sold at that point was Android apps in the very, very, very small Android market at that point. At this point, they have a huge number of credit cards already there. They already have the payment processing. They have music. And like – I think that it'd be a lot easier for people to go on and be like, oh, I have this. I don't have to do any additional, work to purchase this. And I don't know. I think that they will probably get some success. The problem is, as you were saying, Devin, it's a touch device, and trying to sell it online where people can't touch it, which is its primary feature. I mean, it's the primary thing that it does over a regular computer, is going to be somewhat problematic. But on the other hand, people buy their cell phones online usually without touching them.
Usually?
I mean, in my experience, most of my friends are my parents.
I mean, there's a lot of cell phone buying online. But I think one of the things also about a cell phone is that the barrier to entry in terms of cost is much lower. You can buy a cell phone for, between 50. You can get a free one or between $50 and $200. And you want that phone. Whereas with a tablet... it starts at around $400 with the exception of the Amazon one, right? If you want a reasonably nice tablet.
Yeah.
It's a little painful. It's a little painful to pick that money up and go for it. For a device that a cell phone is a necessary device. Once you buy that thing, it's with you all the time. Tablet, kind of luxury device. So I don't think that – I mean, people are selling tablets online. People will continue to do so. I think it'll work. Is it the be-all, end-all? Should Apple be worried? No. Is it a strategy that is part of a bigger multilateral strategy to get Google tablets out there? Yes. It's healthy and it's smart.
Yeah.
All right. moving on here in speaking of amazing Google devices, in a post shared on Google Plus today, in fact, employees of Google Plus ask people for input about the prototype of Project Glass, which is their augmented reality glasses. They said they're sharing this information now because they want to start a conversation and learn from your valuable input. Please follow along as we share some of our ideas and stories. The prototype version Google showed off looked like a very polished and well-designed pair of wraparound glasses with a clear display that sits above the eye. The glasses can stream information to the lenses and allow the wearer to send and receive messages through voice commands. There's also a built-in camera to record video and take pictures. A video released by Google on Wednesday, which we'll embed in our show notes, showed potential uses. For example, a man wanders around the streets of New York City communicating with friends, seeing maps and information, snapping pictures, and concludes with him video chatting with a girlfriend as the sun sets over the city. And all of this is seen through the augmented reality glasses. Did you guys get a chance to check out this video?
Yeah, I did. It reminded me so much of the Microsoft video from those months back. I mean, I don't know.
You're talking about the Microsoft, the Office future Office videos where there's all sorts of touching.
They're using little cards and they can touch, and every surface is touch oriented and everything like that.
Or the Courier, the Microsoft Courier one.
The Microsoft Courier, or even let's go way back. Let's go back to Apple in 1990, whatever, 1980, whatever, when they've got the personal assistant and the professor's talking to it and getting all this data out of it.
Right.
These videos are, I don't know, I don't get them. I don't understand. Like, if you want, drop me a device that has some of this functionality, and like the first iPhone, concept device, right?
Yeah.
Like, you look at that, oh, I can you know, swipe left and right, but I don't have to copy and paste. I can't send a picture message because Apple thought it was stupid.
Right.
I can't do half the stuff I want to do with it, right? But I get where they're going. I get what it needs to do. I get how it moves forward. It's a loss leader. Send me a device that has some of this functionality built in. I know that Zeal Optics has a pair of goggles that actually has augmented reality, GPS, weather, altimeter, speed, things like that, communication, Bluetooth with other devices. Show me some of this technology in action, and then let me come to the obvious conclusions, and then bring me to that next level where I couldn't even have imagined what it is you plan to do with it. But because I've seen your platform, I can now begin to imagine on your level. Yeah. Instead of showing me these like this sort of sci-fi channel kind of stuff where, you know, it's got this ugly thing on my face and I'm walking around and it's, you know, showing me like functionality that probably will not occur the way they're showing it to you. And that's the biggest problem. People will be disappointed when it first comes out. Let me just finish this one thing.
Yeah.
People get disappointed, and the reason why they get disappointed is because you've sold them on this idea that's got great expectations, that makes great expectations. And then it comes out, it doesn't have this stuff first off, and the market has changed. For whatever reason, all the cool little things that you never thought of have happened, so people are looking into a different direction in order to get something similar accomplished, or something similar has been accomplished in a different venue or whatever. So you end up with this video that's kind of cool for its time, but just like watching an old sci-fi show where they're still using computers and with big buttons and no one's actually like using a cell phone, it becomes outdated before you can even get to it. And that's what's so annoying about all this stuff.
I don't think the problem is – I mean, I think I agreed entirely with you, Dwayne. I think the problem even actually goes beyond the fact that they released a concept video like this. I think – I mean, okay, so look at the – I think the whole approach of going to the market and saying, hey, we're going to build this awesome thing. What do you want? I mean, it sounds cool in theory, but as a marketing strategy, it works out terribly. I mean, look at the ideas that the market came up with for what the iPhone was going to look like. Like, the pre-iPhone like rumors were to have like the click wheel thing. I mean, those were terrible ideas, but you know, that's what you're going to get out of the market. You're just going to get this tons of random useless ideas, and then more importantly, as you were saying, like you're going to set these ridiculously unrealistic expectations. I mean, you're asking people what they want. It's like, oh, well, we want it to do magic. We want it to have, you know, a ridiculously high resolution screen. And we want it to be able to have a ridiculously high processor and 15-hour battery life and not give me cancer because of all the radiation around my head. And, you know, it's just like a million things which are not going to be technically feasible. So even if they pull it off, even if they pull off a decent product, they're setting themselves up for failure, just simply by going to the market and asking it. And I don't know. I still stand by what I said a few weeks ago when this first came up. This is the sort of device that's spectacular for sci-fi movies where you want people to like look cool. But even in sci-fi movies, when have you seen people actually using the little things in front of their heads? It just sort of looks cool
on there, right?
You don't actually use it. It's just sort of there for not looking. And in a society where people spend thousands of dollars to not have to wear a face covering, i.e. glasses.
Yeah, we're focused on like we zap ourselves. We take lasers and shoot them into our face in order to not wear glasses. And now you're telling me you're going to give me big, bulky glasses?
Well, and then all the people who, like me, you know, are okay wearing something on your face are going to be unable to wear something on their face because, you know, I already have something.
Well, this technology may actually make it to contact lens form. It's been speculated because they're...
Yeah, how do you power that? How do you plug that in at night?
I'll tell you how. What do you call it? What's it? The where it's... where there's no metallic contact.
Induction?
And yes, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Induction.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to sound like a stupid Luddite or whatever, but I just do think that I look at that thing and I look at that girl at the end, and she's not wearing the glasses, but she's still talking to him. So apparently she's on some sort of FaceTime thing. But what is she looking at? She's looking at his eyes, because that's what he's – you know what I mean? Like, where's that camera? So, you know, I'm just like looking at it and I'm sort of like, yeah, it's not all worked out yet. But at the same time, I guess – I don't know. I think it's one of these things where I'd rather not – you know, I'd rather not see it until they've got actually something in the pipe that's going to be, you know, useful and marketable and whatever. Because right now, soliciting crazy random ideas, you know, from
– Well, you know, it was a very ambitious – kind of blue sky video, but I mean, if you'd told me, you know, two years ago that there would be self-driving cars driving around the streets without a single system-related accident, I wouldn't have believed you.
Right, but that's because 2 years ago, Google came out with the beta of the hardware of the car. 2 years ago, we were looking at the hardware of the car. We're like, wow, it can actually do some stuff. And even though it wasn't finished yet, we were able to look at that and say, I can see where they're going with that. And now we have laws about it, and the car's just driving around blind people and all those other things. Because they gave us the hardware first. They gave us that beta, that alpha, if you want to call it, whatever it was. They gave us this Prius with this crazy crap on top of it, and this the whirring, like, you know, satellite dishes and all this other nonsense, and it worked.
So you want to see something, not just a video.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. I want to see. It doesn't have to be like the first iPhone. Again, mm-hmm. It wasn't the most amazing device around, but, you know, it hinted at what's possible. So I want to see something material that I can then expound on in my own mind. And that's exactly what happened with the iPhone. That's what happened with the Google car, you know. And I think that's what's so exciting. But when you just show me this stuff, whether it's the Apple thing back in the day, the Microsoft thing recently with the card, the super swiping everywhere, or this thing, it's just kind of like, okay, I wasted 5 minutes of my life.
I'll bet that they're closer than you think.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, no.
All right. Well, let's move on here. This is our final headline for the night before we get into our main topics here. And this is regarding the CEO of OMG Pop, whose whirlwind popular app, Draw Something.
I love that app.
Yeah.
Oh, great, my God.
Great game. And OMG Pop was recently purchased by Zynga in, I think, a brilliant move on Zynga's part for whatever however long it'll keep their company alive. We kind of discussed that last week. Anyway, the CEO of OMG Pop posted a tweet in response to an employee who didn't wish to join with OMG Pop in moving to Zynga. He said the one OMG Pop employee who turned down joining Zynga was the weakest one on the whole team. Selfish people make bad games. Good riddance. I thought that was really kind of in poor taste, particularly for a public CEO, a CEO of a public company, to be saying that about one of their employees.
I guess this is part of what happens, like, maybe when you have such young people running these things or whatever. Yeah. But I feel like there's no need to respond. Maybe it's also part of what happens on social media. It's just such a part of your life that you just express everything, what you're eating, when you have to use the bathroom, et cetera. But this is kind of a non-story for me. Okay, he wants to leave. He wasn't happy about it. He didn't have to go into it. You just smile.
Well, especially when there was – I think – I mean, there was a comment on Hacker News that summed this up entirely, which is basically, what did he expect to get out of this? Like, what? There's no upside to him for saying this,
right?
But you know, I think it makes him look particularly bad because this particular employee had a very well thought out article on in which he wrote. I don't remember what the publication was, but basically writing out why he decided not to join Zynga, and he was, you know, extremely clear that he basically. You know, he was amply compensated. He didn't, you know, claim that he had been wronged in any way. He simply, you know, laid out his reasons why he didn't want to join Zynga. And he came across actually looking, you know, very mature and, you know, smart for basically choosing, you know, his interests and passions for a third-party game that he made over you know, a financial decision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to sort of come back with it with like, well, actually, he was the worst anyway. It just sort of, I don't know, looks bad.
Maybe he got pressure from Zynga. Maybe the Zynga guy was just furious.
Maybe.
Yeah, he might have. I don't know.
It seems weird to single out one employee, but I thought that this was kind of in poor taste for, especially for a CEO. I mean, you're right. There's no reason for it. There's no upside for him to do this, but there you go. Anyway, that's it for our headlines. Before we move into our main topic, I want to talk a little bit about our sponsor, audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I wanted to talk about this week is called Jacked, The Outlaw Story of Grand Theft Auto. Now, I don't know if either of you guys are big Grand Theft Auto GTA players, but for those of you who aren't familiar, it's one of the biggest and most controversial video game franchises of all time. Since its release in 97, it's pioneered the use of everything from 3D graphics to the voices of top Hollywood actors and repeatedly transformed the world of gaming. Despite its incredible innovations in the game industry, it's also been a lightning rod of debate, spawning accusations of ethnic and sexual discrimination, glamorizing violence, and inciting real-life crimes. And this book tells the turbulent and mostly unknown story of GTA's wildly ambitious creator, Rockstar Games, the invention and evolution of a franchise, and the cultural and political backlash it provoked. I think it's fascinating when books like this come out and they really kind of drill down into one particular, especially video games, hardly ever get full books about video games. And in particular,
even the big ones, yeah, you don't see this kind of thing happening around Halo, yeah. You know, one right. of the other biggest franchises around. You don't see like the Mario Brothers tell all book come out.
Actually,
you
know I mean? Do have that book.
Oh, that's I apologize.
That's another book that I recently picked up, which is kind of the tell all book about Super Mario. But I think a book like this is fascinating, that where you drill down into one particular game and get into, especially a game that's so near and dear to my heart. I love GTA because I take it with a grain of salt and know that even though it is misogynistic and highly violent, that you know, it has its tongue firmly in its cheek. So this book is written by David Kushner. It's narrated by Adam Werner. And let's take a little listen to a snippet from this book.
GTA revolutionized an industry, defined one generation, and pissed off another, transforming a medium long thought of as kid stuff into something culturally relevant, darkly funny, and wildly free.
So that was a little clip from Jacked, the outlaw story of Grand Theft Auto by David Kushner, narrated by Adam Werner. And that book, along with any of Audible's other 10,000-plus titles, can be yours. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook plus the trial to give you a chance to check out their service. We're going to take a little break here. Give you guys at home a chance to listen to some music. But when we come back, we're going to talk about Apple TV, the upcoming Apple TV innovation versus existing set-top boxes and console devices and how they compare, plus some bad news for Yahoo all around. So take a listen to this and come on back.
We'll be right back.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down Live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Christopher Bernard, and let's talk a little bit about Apple's upcoming TV set. I was going to say Apple TV, but I'm sure that it's going to have its own name, whenever it comes out, iTV perhaps. But all I know is that when CEO Tim Cook shows off whatever it's going to be called, he'll likely call the voice activated universal search a revolutionary way to interact with your television. What he probably won't mention is that that already exists. Indeed, much of what Apple is likely to build into its TV is available today on a gadget whose interface is just as easy to use as anything Apple will cook up. I'm speaking of, namely, the Xbox 360. Now, Duane, you brought this topic up to us last week, and we didn't get a chance to get to it this week, last week. But
right. I mean, I brought it up more as just a conversation piece. I don't know if there's a definitive answer here, but I feel like, to your point, Andy, we're in a great period of flux where, on the one hand, entertainment and online video are rapidly overtaking TV with the incoming generations of young people who now have incomes and don't want to spend it on cable. On the other hand, you've got the gaming generation who really enjoys that. And as I sit in front of my Apple TV and my Xbox, there's some of that on both sides. I have a gaming console that is very capable at giving me entertainment. And very capable of doing that very easily. And I have a TV entertainment device in the Apple TV that I can actually play games on via AirPlay mirroring. Now, the experience of gaming, obviously, it's a secondary, possibly tertiary for the Apple TV. But they both fulfill you can look at a feature set of them and you see a whole bunch of things in common. But what I think this article on Slate talks about is the fact that Apple can come out with some Siri-based television set, and it may, as awesome as that sounds to some people, it kind of, I think, screams of old Apple, of Apple when things were too expensive for anyone to really purchase, whereas now Apple has, like, the cheapest 10-inch tablet spec for spec. Apple has the cheapest, well-to-do cell phone spec for spec, and the 3GS and then the iPhone 4. The iPhone 4S doesn't actually exceed any of its competitors in terms of price when you go spec for spec. So I think that what we're seeing is an Apple, at least in their iOS devices, that is approachable financially. And when you look at a TV, you're like, the costs in order to put that together, the glass, the panels, the everything, tying into it, that's problematic. And then when you look at what the competition is for the functionality, that's where the Xbox really begins to take off. And it's not to take away from the PS3. The PS3, you got your Netflix, you got your Vudu, you got a bunch of things.
And Amazon now, as of today.
And you got Amazon just came to the PS3, but it was on the Xbox for some time. Oh. And a big thing with the Xbox is that it's not just that you can use a controller or a remote control to get to these services on the television set. It's that I think the stat was recently that Xbox recently – more people are using Xbox for entertainment than they are for Xbox Live gaming, online gaming. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why is because of its complete intuitive user interface. It's got this Metro interface, which is fundamentally different from the Apple app one that you find on like the Apple TV and your iOS devices. And it's also got the Kinect, which is one of the most intuitive, button-free ways to manipulate your screen in front of you without having to put your fingers on it too. So it's really something, and it's focused on the living room. And I think that what we're looking at here is a device that it truly is what it was designed to be, an Xbox. Put whatever you want. It's your movie box, it's your game box, it's your social connectivity box, it's whatever box you want, Xbox. And I really feel that, especially with Comcast Xfinity attached to it, the ability to get to your college sports and so on via ESPN. I feel like what you're seeing there is something that Microsoft is rarely able to do, which is to really have a sticking in the living room and have a new and innovative way of interacting with it. And I feel like Apple is going to have a big hurdle to get there. And so I kind of want to know what you guys think in this emerging sort of like console focused, no cable box, get your content through the internet kind of way.
It sounds to me like what you're saying is that with convergence of all of these associated technologies, that it seems like whatever Apple comes out with is going to be negligible compared to what we've already got with not just the Xbox, but as you said, with PS3 and, you know, convergence has kind of inundated all of these console systems and set-top boxes.
Yeah. You know, I think there's still a problem that Microsoft has, though, that for a huge number of users, like, Xbox is a gaming platform. I mean, it's been so heavily marketed as much as one that it's going to be very difficult for an awful lot of non-gaming type consumers to see it as anything but a gaming system. I mean, no matter how good the features are, like, it's going to require a paradigm shift for people to start thinking of it as an alternative. I mean, yeah, if you happen to have a you know, an Xbox and you realize that it has those features, then yeah, you'll certainly use it. But I mean, like, you know, for my in-laws are a perfect example. I mean, they have an Xbox. I think they actually have two Xboxes. I don't know. But they went out and bought a Roku player because, you know, in their mind, the Xbox is for games and the Roku player is for, you know, doing stuff. So it's not just a matter of features. It's a matter of how people think about the devices and what they use them for and what they go to them for. That I think is really going to make the difference is which one ends up winning in the marketplace.
I think regardless of what features the other devices come out with, there's definitely going to be a market for an Apple version.
Oh yeah,
yeah. They've got.
Yeah, I think it's getting to the point where they can't really ignore the TV market anymore because there is so much change happening in it, and you know that they have. You know, they have the smallest screen in your phone, the medium screen in the tablet, the bigger screen in your computer. The only remaining one is your TV. You know, I would not put it out of Apple's way to actually say they might actually sell regular TVs. I mean, let's not forget, like, Apple has some of the best displays on the market for...
You mean, like, the cinema display?
Yeah. I mean, they have such amazing, you know, processes for making extremely high resolution displays on, you know, the phone and the iPhone, and extremely good color displays in, you know, their laptops and stuff. I mean, it's entirely possible that they might not just make a little boxier TV, but actually make a TV with a tuner.
Yeah, but the content has to catch up, right? So, like, you can have, if you make a 4K TV today, no one's going to want to buy it because, first of all, it's going to cost a fortune. And second of all, the content isn't there. The content's at 1080p. I'm not saying Apple can't do it. To say that would be stupid. I'm not trying to predict that kind of thing. What I'm saying is that when I'm looking at what's around, I look at the, like, as a guy with a connected TV and who looked for a connected TV, I still think that with the devices that come out and everything that they can do, there's so much room for the dumb monitor and the powerful connection, which gives people options. To spend $3,000 on, you know, a 46-inch TV that has, you know, an Apple TV device built into it and, you know, some extra features in the branding of Apple, $2,000, $3,000, whatever it's going to cost, that you know, there's value in that, sure. But is that value enough for someone not to spend X amount of dollars less on a Sony or something, or even if you want to go all the way down to, like, you know, Vizio or whatever, but let's go mid-range, like, to a nice Samsung, and have devices attached to that. And then if the device doesn't work, they can take it back, they can do whatever, and your monitor, that screen remains a screen. So I'm not trying to naysay what Apple's trying to do, but I do think that the interoperability of multiple devices connected is key. And then I also think that the real big innovation that the Kinect has is that you don't have to talk to it in order to get things done, and it's a new and intuitive way of getting things done, moving through Netflix, moving through Metro with your hands, just waving.
You know, I'll play devil's advocate and say that nobody does that. Like, the one thing that I can say that Apple kind of one of their fortes is that they build on previously familiar human experiences.
Paradigms, yeah. I give you that.
And what you're talking about is something that people don't usually have never done in control.
I don't know. I think everybody in the tech world and beyond has looked at Minority Report and been like, yes, that's how I move around data. That's how I would move pictures. That's how I'd move that's how I would swipe. And the swiping isn't counterintuitive. Look at your iOS device. You swipe.
Yes, but swiping on the iOS is based on turning the pages in a book. So it's not a new experience there. I mean, that's
but it's also been moved over. So when you go to Instapaper, the default is to swipe over. When you're in when you're going from app to app on an iPad, the default is you take your five fingers and you swipe over. Mm-hmm. Right? Like that's how they do it. It's moved away, like Flipboard, right? What is that? That's not a book. Who knows that? It's a board. It's flipping. It's a whole new.
But how they chose to implement the interface on that is by making it similar to reading a book. So it's very familiar territory.
And
I'm saying using a remote, for me, using a remote is pushing buttons on a small device, not using gestures.
Yeah. My guess is that.
So wait, are you saying using what's preferable or what? Like I'm saying to take that book paradigm and put it in front of you and say if you're a kid, if you're like, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, you know, looking for the button on the remote control of something you can't actually read isn't going to make as much sense as being able to take your hand and wave it aside, as I've seen the toddlers in my family do.
I'm saying if you're a UX designer, you're going to win hearts and minds a lot easier by making an experience that people are already familiar with.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I don't disagree.
That's the real challenge of TV, right? I mean, the fact that everyone's very familiar with the TV interface, and yet everyone also agrees that TVs have terrible, terrible, terrible UX. I mean, right. I feel far more comfortable as an engineer. I feel far more comfortable working in a terminal-only Linux server than I do trying to figure out how to deal with a strange TV. Like, yeah, I don't know my own TV very well, but you know, you look at a TV you haven't used before, and there's like 15,000 buttons, and you're like, okay.
And that's where I think Kinect and Apple TV are going to be really powerful, because you get to take any screen and turn it into whatever you want to do with it. For me, I think with an Apple TV, like a television set, they're going to have to, like, part of it's going to be the way the actual hardware interacts with your voice, etc. If they do indeed use Siri. But I'm looking at something like the Kinect, and Andy, I think that when I see the toddlers in my family manipulate that with their hands and move from place to mm-hmm. place, because they reach out and there's a feedback based on how they've moved their arms, and these are little people who don't have the biases that people who've been raised on remote controls or whatever have.
I'll grant you that.
It's intuitive. It's very intuitive. And even when I look at someone like my grandmother take action to the Kinect, the woman is way pre-computer age, so she doesn't know how to use a mouse, but she can use a Kinect to get from place to place. You know, oh, children, I'll do this, whatever, yada, yada, yada. So I think that, to your point, swiping based on a book does work. And I think that swiping is actually – it works even better than we think it does. Now – I'm not saying that Apple won't come out with something, and the whole talking thing is the whole like getting Siri to work and everything. That's astounding stuff. But I do think that one of the problems I know I have with voice activated stuff is having to open my mouth when I don't want to. And that is to say, I'm in a room, my girlfriend's in the room next door. I want to get to the next whatever, you know, like I don't want to have to like talk to the television set. I want to just have the television set know what I want by manipulating my hands. It's like typing late at night or waking up early in the morning and IMing with a bunch of friends instead of getting on the phone. There's a certain quietness that I think is important. And that's what I find when I'm using Siri, I don't have. I don't want to speak to my computer. If I'm speaking to anybody, it's on the telephone. I don't want to speak to any of those systems at the insurance company when you're trying to like get through their like menus. I don't really want to speak to Siri too much. And I don't want to you know, I just don't need to talk to things that aren't people.
It's also a rather serious accessibility issue. If you have to be able to speak in order to use your television, is actually one of the, you know, technologies that has a pretty good system for dealing, you know, with with hearing impairments, you know, with the closed captioning system, and having a speak only interface seems like it would rather easily get in the way.
What about the disability issue? If you have to make broad movements to change your
there's a two pronged problem there. I mean both of these things will have a hardware or something, right? Like you can use with the Kinect, it's not how you use it only. You got to use the controller, you know, eventually if you want to. Like if you can't move your hands or whatever, with the Apple TV, I'm sure there's going to be some sort of tactile remote control in the end. So disability, I think they'll get around that. They're going to want to be as able as possible. I do think that making a broad gesture with a hand in a relatively clumsy fashion as compared to a smooth and tight gesture on a remote control is the reason why someone like my grandma can navigate certain aspects of the Kinect, because she can't like thumb a remote control because of her arthritis, but she can wave her arm and something will move.
On the plus side, to your point, Microsoft is making more detailed Kinects with more detailed sensors. So,
I think the resolution has to get better.
Yeah, that technology is going to improve there. So, who knows? It's kind of all a moot point until we actually know what Apple is actually doing.
But just the idea that like today, like, you know, there's a lot of talk about this device that hasn't come out yet, and I was just thinking. This article is also thinking the minimalist approach of the current Apple TV is quite brilliant. I mean, we're talking about the Xbox, we're talking about this and that, but in the end, one of the kind of coolest things about the Apple TV is that you don't even notice its footprint. I mean, it makes the Mac Mini look huge and ridiculous. Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of those things where I really enjoy the form factor. I really enjoy the device itself. I'm learning how to use it in a better way all the time. And, you know, obviously I'm excited to see what they come out with next. But in an age where you can, like, literally swipe your hand to get certain things done, you know, we're kind of, it's kind of exciting already, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yep. All right, let's move on to our next, our co-hot topic, which is, of course, the stuff with the Facebook and Yahoo. So a couple weeks ago, we talked about Yahoo's patent lawsuit against Facebook, where they had filed a claim saying that Facebook had violated 10 patents that Yahoo was holding. And Facebook has just taken strong aim back at Yahoo's patent lawsuit with an answer and counterclaim filing of its own, alleging infringement over a number of issues,
including some patents that were taken in before Facebook was founded, which clearly means that they were purchased.
And I believe that some of those patents were previously owned by Yahoo, if I'm not mistaken. So it's kind of a weird irony here. Ted Ulliott, the general counsel of Facebook, said, from the outset, we said we'd defend ourselves vigorously against Yahoo's lawsuit, and today we filed our answer as well as counterclaims against Yahoo for infringing 10 of Facebook's patents. While we're asserting patent claims of our own, we do so in response of Yahoo's short-sighted decision to attack one of its partners and prioritize litigation over innovation. One of those patents is against Yahoo's advertising on Yahoo, which is what makes up most of Yahoo's revenue. So, in other words, Mark, Facebook CEO and co-founder Mark Zuckerberg does not like being poked by new Yahoo CEO Scott Thompson, especially on the eve of a $100 billion IPO. This filing couldn't come at a worse time for Yahoo, who today made a massive round of layoffs official and cut 2,000 jobs, or 14% of its total workforce. So like a 1-2 punch against Yahoo from on Facebook's side. What do you guys think about this, the filing and then the Yahoo's massive round of layoffs?
It doesn't look good for Yahoo. No. I mean, it makes them look desperate. extremely desperate. This is the second time in, what, 3 months that we've talked about layoffs at Yahoo. Yeah. Clearly they're trying to cut back and become more lean and everything, but I mean, the bigger problem that Yahoo has is more direction and vision.
Like, right.
They need to show that they have direction and vision. They have good engineers, or they had good engineers. But what they don't have is any sort of sense of direction or what exactly they're going to be doing with things. And I mean, all this stuff at the moment, at the very best, is buying them time.
Right.
But it's really bad from a, like, you know, if they want to continue having good engineers, like,
it's a terrible PR precedent.
No one's going to work for them. No one good, at least. You know, either they're going to have to pay, you know, ridiculously high to get people to hire, or they're going to end up with, you know, a relatively low quality pool of workers. And that's unfortunate, because I, you know, there used to be a lot of really good people at Yahoo, but I think a lot of them have left, and any remaining ones should leave.
wow. Okay.
I mean, do you remember there was the CEO of I can't remember the name of the company. It was a recent CEO of a startup. You know, came publicly after Yahoo filed their lawsuit against Facebook, saying that he would never hire somebody, you know, who was working at Yahoo at this point, if they ever left. And I think for a lot of companies, it's sort of becoming like a unnecessary baggage on your resume. Like, oh, why did you stay at Yahoo until 2012?
Right.
You know.
So what about those kids coming out of school and they see a job at a company and they need some money? Like, they can't go to Yahoo. I mean, that's
but you know what?
There's a market in, you know.
Oh, I'm sure there will. But
you're a 20 something year old person.
But if you're
the thing is, though, is like Google and LinkedIn and Twitter and Facebook are also all going after the same kids.
It's kind of like a self fulfilling prophecy, though, because if you're savvy enough to be in that industry, then you already know that joining up with Yahoo is going to be.
I don't think it's that simple, guys. I think you're guessing at people's motivations, and you can't understand their economic needs. And there's a labor market out there, and if Yahoo's going to hire people for the market price, people will work for them. And that's the way the market works. And to say that you're Yahoo's not good enough to even, like, I mean, yes, it's going to be a barrier when they have other options, they'll choose them. But the idea that I won't hire someone who was at Yahoo during this time, they're not management, you know. And they can't just leave. You can't just leave your job, you know. Like, so it's childish. Like, it's maybe you can.
The thing is, though, like, I mean, the hiring market in Silicon Valley right now is sort of the opposite of how it is for the rest of the country.
It doesn't matter, though. You still have to think about, like, the logistics of leaving. Like, you can't just up and leave your job without another one. Now, people might be looking, but then they're still there for however long they are. And regardless,
but people do. We have like a recruiting product at Startup Digest, and we literally have people in there who just literally quit their jobs and are just looking around for something because they're bored. Like, if you're a good engineer out here, you really can quit your job and find something that will pay substantially better in a short period of time.
I don't know. I mean, I've looked at the actual data of what's going on in Silicon Valley and in around the country, and it's never as simple as saying, "Oh, I don't want to work here because of the decision you made just now." Oh, you filed a lawsuit, I'm going to quit. Like, things don't work like that. Like, that's just, I mean, that's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous, guys. Like, think about the economic, like, situation there. If that were the case, people would be moving back and forth in jobs all the time. But that's just not how it works. When your company makes a decision you don't like, you might begin to look. You might look around. You might see what's out there. You try to go. There's a counteroffer. Like, I don't know how long you spend time in the workforce, but that's just, it doesn't happen like my company's about to sue somebody, so I'm going to quit. Like, it doesn't, that's just not how reality works. Like, I don't know what to say. Like,
Yahoo says it'll save $375 million upon the completion of its layoffs. And they currently expect $125 to $145 million in a pre-tax cash charge relating to employee severance packages. And the product division is expected to be hit the hardest through these layoffs.
Yeah. I mean, Yahoo's products are the big problem, right? They don't really make them. They buy things and they go to die. And yeah. And that, if anything, is a big reason to roll out. Like, they're going to do this layoff. They're suing Facebook. It's a dumb move because Facebook is a big driver to Yahoo. I'm sure that when you people have Yahoo News and they put it on Facebook, that's how they get there. But this is a move of desperation for a company that is subject to a stock market that's focused on short-term financial growth over long-term gain, right? Like, the CEO gets in there. You need to show that the company has value, that we have assets, that we have something. And that's the cheap trick that this new CEO is trying to make. That's the fundamental problem with Yahoo. And I think that's what should turn people off. But there are people who are vested in whatever stock they have. There are people who, whatever, you know, they've guaranteed whatever. So that those people aren't going to leave. But Yahoo has totally screwed up in terms of the management from Yang through, you know, the guy who was just right after Yang, or the lady who was after Yang. Like, this company is in a financial wreck akin to like RIM, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Even I think even maybe even worse than, well, I don't know. It's kind of a toss-up.
It's hard to be worse than RIM.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I really feel bad for the 2,000 jobs that have been cut so far, and hope that those people get placed somewhere relatively soon. But I mean, it's Yahoo's own fault. It's the management of Yahoo's own fault for letting it get this bad. And I and most of all, I hope that nothing bad happens to Flickr, which is probably my favorite Yahoo.
Or property. I mean, Yahoo Sports is also really powerful. Like, the Yahoo's ability, like, their fantasy football is wonderful. It's a big driver for them. Yahoo also recently had an issue where things weren't getting into their inbox because they changed their filters, and so they lost a significant amount of revenue on that front. You know, they're just kind of, no one's really paying attention there, so things are kind of falling apart, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And the big products like Flickr, Yahoo Sports is huge, and the amount of money they make on the advertising on that side is also pretty big. So I know not a lot of geeks watch sports, but I mean, it's huge. So I'm hoping that there's a better way for those guys.
One last thing about Yahoo.
Yeah.
I feel like if we were to take every single conversation that we've had, you know, from time immemorial and mention, like, look at our mentions of Yahoo, they'd all be about, like, the fall of this once amazing company.
Yes.
And that's, what was that's the last good article? Like, I'm trying to think the last, like,
good headline about Yahoo.
I think it was Pipes. Yahoo Pipes? I mean, that's the last good thing I remember them doing.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I mean, IFTTT has basically taken over that for people who need that kind of functionality.
I think that the thing we'll talk about most of all after Yahoo's dead and gone is how surprised we were that it lasted as long as it did.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm kind of getting at. It's a sinking ship. I mean, even AOL is doing better than Yahoo. Think about that.
Yeah. Wow. Ouch.
Wow, that is the end of the discussion.
And on that
ding,
note,
ding, round over. Game, set, and match.
Okay, so we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. But when we come back, we're going to lighten things up and talk about this last week's April Fools on the web, which I'm sure everybody here experienced in one form or another. So take a listen to this, and we'll be right back.
Young and bright, but now just a dim light. Off in the distance, a falling star, following the path of least resistance. If I still fight, it's just that I'm afraid I'll slide under that spell. My
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Christopher Bernard. And this last week was April 2nd. And April 2nd has a very special place on the web, being April Fool's Day.
You mean the day after April Fool's Day?
I'm sorry, April 1st. I just played my own April Fool's joke
we
on
myself.
We just
did our own April Fool's.
So April 1st has a very special place. I should check a calendar. So, and this April Fool's was no exception. I think, you know, usually on April Fool's, typically Google goes way out of their way. Like, they go above and beyond. And I think it's because there are so many different divisions of Google that each...
Trying to top each other?
Yes, or maybe not even trying to top each other, but everyone has to have their own say. They don't necessarily consolidate their... This is one of those cases where the right hands of Google don't know what the left hands are doing, and so they all pitch in and try to outdo themselves. And I think in this case, Google Maps probably was the winner of all the subdivisions of Google with their Google Maps in 8-bit joke, where...
yeah, that was really impressive.
So essentially what this was that you could flip a switch and see the regular Google Map topography, but all rendered in 8-bit graphics. And when you zoomed in, and that carried all the way through to when you zoomed in, and then when you went to Street View, they kind of filtered Street View to look 8-bit graphic with a limited palette and with the posterized colors. So I thought that was brilliant. Mm. What else did Google do? They did their Chrome multitask mode, where you could use one mouse on multiple screens or in multiple directions at the same time. Which actually worked. You would go to a particular site, and we'll have the links to all of these in the show notes, so you can try them out for yourself.
Don't forget that glasses thing.
Well, that actually turned out to be real. The one that I really thought was a April Fool's joke that we discussed earlier that turned out to be real was Ashton Kutcher going to play Steve Jobs.
You thought that was a joke?
I wish that was a joke.
Oh, really? You don't think he'll do a very good job?
I think he'll do fine. Google Racing. So this one I thought was also pretty brilliant. Google announced a partnership with NASCAR where they were going to have their self-driving cars be part of NASCAR. And they had a video that showed Sergey Brin behind the wheel of the Google Racing car, self-driving car, but he's holding his hands out to show that he's not driving the car. The car is driving itself, but of course at like 200 plus miles per hour.
That sounds like a pretty good one. Yeah. I didn't actually see that one on the day. The one I saw on the day was honestly the one that distracted me the most. Mm-hmm. Was the Reddit timeline. I sort of gotten to a point where I just sort of wait for to hear about what sort of the best ones are and don't actually try to go looking them out. But Reddit timeline was kind of amazing. They sort of made like a subreddit for different timelines with the idea that you could get past, you know, Reddits from the future and the past and everything. And there was some extremely clever and hilarious, 0 AD ones and 94,000 AD ones. It was pretty entertaining. Although it was kind of sad to see the lack of historical knowledge, particularly the 0 AD ones, where a lot of people didn't realize that 0 AD is supposed to be when Christ was born, not when he was.
Ooh, that's embarrassing.
The whole top five ones were. It was always like some joke about that, and then the first comment would be like, "Guys, 0 AD was." Yeah.
Well, but, lots some of good Doctor Who jokes. Christ was born long before there.
Well, it was probably wrong, but still, like, you know,
I hear you.
It was pretty fun.
Is that still available on Reddit, or did they get rid of it?
Uh-oh, Andy and Reddit.
Let us find out.
You would think I would know, but I don't. I know it's off their main – they've removed it from their main site, but I think I would have thought that they would have preserved that.
Yeah, you can still go to reddit.com/t and then colon and then whatever one of the ones you want to go to. So, like, they're all subreddits now. So, like, 1955 is now reddit.com/r/t:1955. Kind of an awkward thing. But you can still redirect them. So if you type in t/1955.
I love it when the April Fool's sites last, you know, after the fact. And a lot of the, like, a lot of the Google ones do. They've kept around for a while. Google did one for YouTube where you could order the entire YouTube library on DVD, and they'd send it to you via shipping truck on huge pallets of individual DVDs the pallets themselves were already pre-categorized into, you know, people and travel, the categories that already exist on YouTube.
There's more. Like, I was thinking about Netflix and YouTube the other day. Like, you literally don't have enough time in your life to see all the content.
Right.
You know, have you ever looked at some of the videos that have, like, less than 1,000 views? You're spending your life well by not watching all that content. It's really kind of sad.
It's true. Well, I mean, and that's the thing. Like, there's a lot of, for all the awesomeness, is so much bunk. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
What else was out there around the web? Looking at here. Oh, ThinkGeek. They always do a great job over at ThinkGeek. ThinkGeek, typically on April Fool's, they gather about 6 to 8 different products that... now, ThinkGeek, for people that don't know, is online shopping for tech-related products. But tech and
goofy
tech and geek,
geek,
yeah,
goofy, geeky
geek
junk.
Culture products, and they put together about 6 to 8 different products that are completely April Fool's products and will never and don't exist. However, that one caveat to that is that typically out of the 6 to 8 products, they take a poll, an email poll, and they ask people to choose which one that they'd actually like to see really be made, and they will make that product, and you'll usually see it about 6 months later. Amongst the ones that they had this year was the Star Wars Admiral Akbar singing bass.
It's like just like dust collectors. Like, it's all like really novel stuff, and then you're sitting there, and like your girlfriend's like, "You spent $10 on that." Right, like that's what happened. Like with my pipe, I have a pipe.
Oh, uh huh.
It's like a wooden like pipe that you would smoke, but for the fact that it only like really has bubbles coming out of it. But like I use this pipe. Like I put it in my mouth and mm-hmm, I get thoughtful with it, and you know, that's just kind of how it is.
They had a digital wizard hoodie that lights up, that basically it claims that you can perform like 10 different spells, and the hoodie actually lights up and changes, has motion sensing sleeves. What else? The one of my favorite ones was of Tech Geek's offering was the Keurig K-Cup 5-star meals, which is... you know those Keurig cups that pop into the coffee makers, and you can brew a single shot of coffee through them.
Like a teacup.
Yeah. So these have entire meals that you can make through them.
How awesome would that be?
Yeah. Ugh. Hot wings, corn dogs, donuts, tacos, salad.
You know, I'm pretty sure that what ThinkGeek does here is they basically just like come up with a bunch of random ideas, throw them up there, and whichever ones get the most traction, that's their product line for the next year.
Yeah, it's like Threadless, right? You go to Threadless, and like the shirt has one whatever, so they know that it's worth making. And then once it runs out, you get to fill in this little form, and it says, you know, do you want, like, would you be interested in buying the reprint? So once the number's a critical mass, they're just like, all right, we can reprint this. And like, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like they figure out what the take is, and they build to that take. It's brilliant.
You know, the funny thing about that is that the first TechGeek's been doing this for a few years now. Now, the first couple of years, their April Fool's products were really kind of outrageous and not producible. But ever since they started implementing that aspect where you can, where they will actually choose one or two products to that they will produce, their last couple of years, the April Fool's jokes have been not that far outrageous beyond the realm of possibility. They're ones
it's
that,
an opportunity.
That, yeah, that actually could be made, which I think is brilliant on their part. Yeah, and Dave in our chat room says that the tip off was the Tauntaun sleeping bag. I remember that one.
I wonder how it smells.
Better on the outside than in the inside. Okay, what else? There was, I'm looking through this TechCrunch post where they have all of the rest of them. They mentioned the Google.
TechCrunch didn't do anything crazy this year, like release some crazy bit of news a day early that wasn't actually true. Remember when Arrington did that a few years ago?
But that's what they do every day.
I don't think TechCrunch did, but did you see Mashable was... Mashable's joke was that they were purchased by Conan O'Brien and that Conan bought the site for $3,500. And Conan actually recorded a video for them for that.
Oh, nice. Wow. You know, there was a rumor around South By that they got purchased by CNN. I never
South By Southwest got purchased by CNN or Mashable?
Mashable. I remember that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I never heard any.
Wow, Lance Ulanoff bringing Mashable to the next level.
I don't know.
I feel obliged to mention, since we are on Geeks of Doom, that we had our own sort of spate of April Fool's articles as well.
I like that word, spate.
We reported on George Takei's post on Facebook where he was going to be starring in a spin-off of Star Trek, the Star Trek series, where he was the captain of the USS Excelsior, featuring Gilbert Gottfried and Lisa Lampanelli, and J.J. Abrams would be directing and writing the screenplay.
Why must you tease me about these things?
I think I would probably pay to see that myself.
That's what I'm saying. Like, dude, in Star Trek VI, the Undiscovered Country, when he's running the Excelsior, you're like, this man was meant to be captain of the biggest ship in the fleet. And that's all we saw. There could have been a whole spinoff, Sulu, Excelsior, whatever. It didn't have to take place in Captain Picard's time. It could have been in the old time with, you know, Sulu just being Sulu because he was Sulu. Like, he's like, target that explosion and fire. I mean, I got goosebumps just thinking about it.
Geeks of Doom, having kind of a heavy metal focus, pulled their own April Fool's prank with an article that mentioned that the GOP is seeking a headbanger for president, and the man who stepped up to the call was Megadeth's Dave Mustaine. So I thought that was pretty funny and really kind of tuned into the Geeks of Doom readership.
I don't think so Megadeth Megadeth tends to swing the other way, generally.
Well, I think it's probably part of the joke right there.
If they had Metallica and the guy was like, pirating bad, then I would've probably worked. But does the Onion then like just report normal news on the April Fool's Day?
You know, I've never actually called the Onion.
You know, I saw the Onion. They actually did. It's funny because they actually did report comic news, but the Onion probably saw the least traffic of all the sites.
It's a bad time for them.
Yeah, it's a bad time. So they ended up pinning their April 1st articles to the homepage on April 2nd and April 3rd. So it's like they recycled their April 1st stuff because I don't think anyone it is a bad time for them. So one bad day of the year.
That's true, because every other day you're just going to need the Onion to make you not cry at work.
And frankly, I kind of feel like April, because one of the things that is my hobby is finding cool stuff on the internet and posting it to sites like Dig and Reddit. And unless I am finding one of the April Fool's jokes themselves, April 1st is kind of a bad day for me because, you know, I can't get legitimate stories on any of those sites because they're first, either they're inundated with April Fool's jokes or nobody believes the legitimate news that I'm posting. So
you know, as much as I love the stuff that happens on April Fool's and I appreciate all the clever work that goes into it and I enjoy the fact that April Fool's has gone from this holiday that I hardly remember as a child to like the official internet holiday, it is kind of annoying at times. Like it's sort of like don't bother going on the internet day unless you want to be entertained. Like sort of makes me remind just how important the internet is. Like all the things that we actually use it for during the one day when it's kind of useless for doing actual work.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I kind of like it. I feel like it's the day you take off.
Yeah.
Like being frustrated at the internet is, I don't know, being, getting yourself worked up or bothered or upset about April Fool's not being like a whatever. That's just not a good use of your time. You know what I mean?
It's a very internet response, though. Like, whatever tell the internet, you there has to be somebody who's a naysayer. So I will fill that role for April Fool's.
No, I'm just saying, like, it's just kind of like it's the one time where it's going to be goofy. And rather than it causes stress for you not to roll with it. You know what I mean? That's all I'm saying. Like, like for you not to roll with it, it's just going to cause you stress and, like, you know, figure out what you got to do. It's kind of like when the Wikipedia went down. People were, like, really angry. Well, you know, there are other things to do.
One last article on Geeks of Doom that I wanted to mention was this. You know, in one of Geeks of Doom's focus is comics, and there's a recent turn of events in comics where DC Comics launched relaunched their entire line of comic books, and they're calling it the new 52. And so
I thought they were calling it us being lazy.
So our joke on Geeks of Doom was that they're relaunching with the new 52. And the writers at Geeks of Doom actually went out and outlined like tons of individual synopses of comics of what those individual comics plan to do for the new 52. So that's worth a read there. Anything else? Any other thing else you guys saw for the April Fool's stuff before we sign off for the evening?
No.
All right.
Well, that was my joke.
So let me go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you on the internet when you're not here on the show?
You can find me on Twitter.com/DwayneD. You can find me on Google Plus, gplus.to/DwayneD. You can also find me on Flavors.me, see what I'm doing. That's Flavors.me/DwayneD. And you can also find me in Game Center if you use iOS devices, because for some reason I keep on showing up there for these random games that I thought that nobody knew I played because I didn't read my EULA correctly.
I need to add you to my Game Center.
Yeah. And that's Refractions of the Dawn. Oh, you can find me on my Xbox. You don't want to find me on my Xbox.
You know, if I just type in good. Dwayne D on the internet, you like the first. You're the first hit.
Yes. That's the first. Oh, that's Devinger, who decided that I was going to be Dwayne D a long time ago.
Smart,
because he was like, "I can just be Devinger. You need a brand. I think your brand is Dwayne D." And I'm like, "Okay."
Chris, there's how about yourself? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
I did a search for Dwayne D on DuckDuckGo, and he is the top. Although there's a MySpace
another Dwayne D
DJ who's second. You can find me on my Twitter account at Chris Brunor, ChrisBurnor. It's sort of my primary online place at the moment. I'm still working through getting Obtuse up and running on as my blogging platform.
When you figure that out, I would definitely like to use that because it looks so simple and so stark. Yeah.
It's not actually hard. I just haven't had a chance to do the CSS changes that I want to it because I wanted to look like my website, not somebody else's. But yeah, it looks like a pretty easy site to get up and going. And then you can also find me at a Startup Digest. I co-curate our Friday reading list of what we consider to be the best startup articles of the week. And everything else I do is at chrisburnor.com. C-H-R-I-S-B-U-R-N-O-R.
Cool.
That's it.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or gplus.to/MrBabyMan, which is my Google Plus profile that has all my links on there. I should probably find a couple others. Facebook.com/MrBabyMan is another one. You can check out the past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are there on the right-hand sidebar. Just look for our Drill Down logo. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Please sign up at j.mp/subus if you want to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on thedrilldown.com. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.